You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Credo Mobile. With Credo, your voice reflects your values. Check out credomobile.com/majority for details.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, December 19th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, to tell us how you shouldn't smoke a joint if you want to stay out of jail, what you should do to get your get-out-of-jail card free, your free card, whatever that is. You own a bank and you just launder billions of dollars of drug money. Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone magazine. Also on the program today, the latest in the ongoing negotiations. I don't even know what they're for at this point, except for to screw seniors out of a dignified retirement. Also on the program today, what do you do if you own a yacht and you're actually forced to pay for the docking fees? And the right wing provides their solution for the problem of guns in this country, and it involves some of you being cannon fodder. That and more on the program. First up, Robert Bork died. Next up, some good news to start off the program. Y'all recall the Rolling Jubilee from strike debt. Well, the Rolling Jubilee turned out to be a massive success. Initially, they were attempting strike debt to raise $50,000. It would have allowed them to buy about $1 million worth of distressed medical debt on the secondary debt markets. Well, Rolling Jubilee was such a success, they've raised nearly, at this point, $500,000, which will allow them to buy and forgive $10 million worth of medical debt. They are still in the process of buying this debt. However, strike debt has already spent $5,000 to buy $100,000 of distressed medical debt owed by 20 people in upstate New York. And earlier this week on Monday, I guess it was on Sunday, strike debt activists got together to send out the notifications to the unsuspecting recipients of this first round of debt forgiveness. Now, because people who are in this type of situation where perhaps they've had they've been struck by cancer, perhaps they've had some type of accident, whatever it is, They are swamped with medical debt. And as such, they often ignore the notifications they get in mail. So Strike Debt is sending a small box wrapped in holiday gift wrapping paper so that people open it. When they open it, these people are completely unaware that this, their debt has probably, they probably even aware that it's on a secondary market. And the letter included in this box writes, "We write with good news. The above referenced account has been purchased by the Rolling Jubilee Fund, a 501c4 nonprofit organization. The fund is a project of Strike Debt. The mission of this project is to buy and abolish personal debt. We believe that no one should have to go into debt for the basic things in our lives, like healthcare, housing, and education. You no longer owe the balance of this debt. It's gone. A gift with no strings attached. You are no longer have any obligation to settle this account with the original creditor, bill collector, or anyone else." Now, one of the things that people were concerned about, well, what are the tax implications of this? This was written up in many quarters. I hope they have lawyers. Well, it turns out Strike Debt did, in fact, talk to some of the top tax lawyers in the country. There's a lawyer who works in the tax department at a top international tax law firm. Her employer knows that she's advising the Strike Debt. They don't use her name because they don't want it attached to the project. Who cares? And the tax lawyer basically said that there's no issue here. They're not involved in a commercial activity. Doesn't make when Habitat for Humanity, as she said, is helping people build houses, someone still has to buy the lumber. It doesn't change their tax status. The critical thing is that this is a not-for-profit organization. It's not engaged in trying to make any money. So this is a gift that is not going to be taxable. People have, you know, at this point, 20 people have had their medical debt forgiven. There'll be more of this. It's a small, tiny drop in the bucket, but it is very symbolic. And some good news to start off the program and the day. And certainly some great news for some people who have been struggling with medical debt. We're going to take a break, but this breaking now, Obama appoints Biden to head a task force developing proposals to reduce gun violence that he will push no later than January, according to the president. Now, we know that there's been reports of proposals that were generated in the Department of Justice. I imagine we're going to see those rehashed and finally presented. So hopefully, we know how we need a trust but verify program when it comes to the president making any type of vows. And apparently Joe Biden, when we hear things like no Social Security. But we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Taibbi. Hey guys, listeners of the Majority Report know that we try and put our money where our mouth is when it comes to our sponsors. And I can't say enough about Credo Mobile. They're our newest sponsor. They're the only progressive cell company out there. This is really the best of both worlds for me. I'm so excited, I can barely even say the words. We get to support an organization that fights Republican Tea Party extremists, one that holds Democrats accountable, one that funds the progressive movement, and finally helps keep this show on the air. It's really easy for you to sign up now. Go to credomobile.com/majority. That's credomobile.com/majority. You'll get 40% off your monthly voice fee for 1 year. You'll get true unlimited data. No hinky-dinky, you went over with your megabytes. And they'll even give you a buyout credit of $350 to get out of your contract with one of the big corporate providers that you're stuck with now, so that when you show them your bill, essentially, you won't pay a Credo bill until you go over $350. It's a great deal. Go to credomobile.com/majority right now. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's always a pleasure to welcome to the program Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone magazine. Hello, Matt.
What's going on, Sam?
Well, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same, apparently.
Yes, that is true.
It is, you know, another day, another bank that is not just too big to fail, apparently, but too big to suffer any accountability, regardless of what they seem to do.
Right.
Of course, we're talking about the HSBC settlement that was announced, I guess, earlier this week, last week, end of last week.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about HSBC as an institution.
Well, it's a storied British financial institution, one of the largest banks in the world. Its origins trace back to the British colonial days, Hong Kong, and it's one of the largest 10 banks in the world for sure. And it got caught up in what is looking like the largest money laundering story in the history of banking. The announcement last week by the U.S. Justice Department essentially gives the entire collection of people involved in the activity, the illegal activity, a giant pass on everything. There's going to be no individual criminal prosecutions, even though they laundered as much as $9 billion for groups connected to Al-Qaeda, to Hamas, and then Colombian and Mexican drug cartels. So it's a pretty amazing story. Even on Wall Street, people were pretty freaked out about it.
In their defense, do we know if they laundered any money for serial killers? Right? I mean,
we don't know that for certain. Yeah, there's no conclusive evidence on that score.
Although, so, I guess, yeah. I mean, on a technical level, there's an argument to be made that these drug cartels are in fact serial killers, as are these terrorist organizations. But I was really, you know, trying to cut them some slack.
But you digress.
And,
right.
You know, just some individual ones, you know, sort of ones who aren't, who are just doing it for fun, as opposed for profit. So,
right.
Right. And they're not doing it for child pornography producers that we know of, right? I mean, so
right.
I'm just trying right. to, you know, I'm just trying to, I want to try and be fair here. Now they were engaging these activities over the course of up to 15 years. Is that right?
Yeah, and what's kind of amazing about this is that back in 2010, and this is a point in the story that most people don't know about or think about, they were already approached by the government back 2 years ago, and given a cease and desist letter by the FBI, and essentially told, we know that you're laundering money for all of these various groups. We command you to take steps A through Z to stop doing it, including hiring extra personnel to prevent this kind of activity. And the punishment for violating the terms of that cease and desist letter was essentially another cease and desist letter. In other words, they promised not to do it again in 2010. They got caught for doing it again brazenly and on a massive scale, and the punishment is they got to say that they were sorry. Actually, the quote was they were profoundly sorry.
Yes.
And they paid a fine, and then they walked away from it.
This dynamic basically reminds me of the dynamic I have with my 7-year-old daughter, where I tell her, you know, don't do this again, or something bad's going to happen. And then I basically tell her that same thing again.
Right.
And I can assure you, I can assure folks that that's not an effective means of stopping behavior. But ostensibly, the FBI, you know, they have more than just computers to write letters on, right? I mean, they're like policemen.
Not only are they like police, they reportedly are police. And what's amazing about this is that frequently when you get a financial settlement instead of a criminal prosecution, what that signals is that the authorities know what happened, but they don't have the evidence to go forward, right? So like in the Abacus case, which is the Goldman Sachs case where, you know, Goldman was involved in helping a hedge fund swindle a couple of European banks. Well, Goldman got fined $575 million, which is a ton of money, but they didn't go the extra step of really pressing a lot of criminal cases in that instance because it was an extremely difficult activity to prove. The crime was hard to define, and so what everybody kind of took from that settlement was, you know, the government knew what happened, but they just couldn't prove it. That's not the case here. In this case, they had whistleblowers, they had documentary evidence, they had admissions from the company that they had violated at least 4 major banking laws, including the Trading with the Enemy Act and the Bank Secrecy Act. And so they could have just gone wild with these people. And, you know, I mean, as you know, with terrorist prosecutions in the last decade, if you have even an association with terrorism, they can do all kinds of things up to and including, you know, whisking you away in the middle of the night without a trial and you know, taking you somewhere forever. And they eschewed all of those options and just essentially publicly announced that they're not even going to prosecute.
I mean, that's what's so sort of revealing and egregious about this is that we have heard for years now that it's really hard to prosecute these securities violation cases. It's really hard to prove the massive mortgage fraud that took place. It's really hard to prove these are not simple cases. It's very, very hard to do. We don't have the resources, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And now we hear the same reasons as to why we're not prosecuting except for that one, right? We're not hearing
right.
that it's too hard for us to prosecute. It's just that we just don't prosecute banks like this. I mean, tell me what the official Lanny Brewer reasons are as to why there are no criminal prosecutions of HSBC for laundering billions of dollars for ostensibly, I mean, we'll get into this, but when we talk about the hundreds of billions of dollars that we use, trillions of dollars probably at this point, to fight supposedly the supposed drug war, the war on terrorism, all of this, we have heard time and time again that the key is to get their financing. But the biggest, at least that we know of, the biggest sort of conduit for this financing walks away.
Right. Yeah. No, that's what's so incredible about it, is that we have this, we've committed this massive expenditure of resources to a war in Iraq, to a war in Afghanistan, to, you know, the drug war. We appear to be totally committed to putting, you know, extending the absolutely maximum sentences allowable to anybody connected with either terrorism or drugs. And yet here we have, you know, the heart of both of those things. You know, here's where the money is. Here are the high level negotiations that allow these people to do business, and nothing. You know, I mean, they didn't offer really an explanation publicly for why they didn't proceed criminally. There was a lot of, from what I understand, off the record talk, which is why you saw it reported in newspapers like the New York Times, that the reason that they didn't go forward is because they were afraid about systemic concerns, you know, the impact of the collapse of a company like HSBC, which is bogus on a number of levels. Like, you know, first of all, the guilty parties could easily have been removed, and in fact were removed from HSBC without permanent damage to the company. So, you know, if you're going to fire somebody, if you're going to demand that certain people are going to be fired, why can't these individuals be criminally prosecuted as well? It doesn't make any sense at all. There can't possibly be any realistic concerns about, you know, worldwide confidence in the financial system if you're asking for these people to be fired but not prosecuted.
So we have a situation where Lanny Brewer is saying off the record, or at least in background, or, you know, I think the quotes have been attributed to him. So maybe it's you know, just not formal official statement, but he's saying these banks are too big to fail. We're afraid of people losing their jobs. We're afraid
right.
of the financial implications. But we've already supposedly – HSBC claims that we have basically carved out these bad apples. Presumably these guys are going to work for other banks. And so the idea that we can't go and have these individuals be held criminally liable is a joke. It's an absolute...
Yeah, no, it's in Brewer's announcement that this bank has already been forced to replace most of its senior management.
What are they? They put themselves on the market. Like, you know, I've got a good client base. You know, these, I know where I can do for you what I did for HSBC. And from HSBC's standpoint, if they've got to pay a $1.6 billion fine,
I think it's 1.9, yeah.
All right, 1.9, let's call it. So they're 20%. It's like a check cashing fee, right? I'm going to pay 20% off of the profits we made. That's a pretty good deal.
Right, right. And again, what's the percentage that they take from a person in an ordinary drug case? It's 100%. I mean, it's if you are caught up in, if you're a weed dealer and you get caught up in a federal investigation and, you know, they start rolling witnesses up against you, what are they going to take? They're going to take everything you have. They're going to take your house. They're going to take your bank account. They're going to take your wife's property. They're going to take your cars. And, you know, as you know, in these civil asset forfeiture cases, they will actually launch independent prosecutions against pieces of property. You know, it'll be like United States versus, you know, 1300, you know, Maple Avenue, and they'll take the house independent of what happens with your drug case. So they've always, the strategy with drug cases has always been, let's be as aggressive as possible in extracting value and extracting fines from the people involved in this kind of activity. In this case, it looks like they took the minimum amount that they could take that would look like a real fine, that would still be a record fine, but would still leave the company not only viable in the long term, but profitable this year.
And we should say that, I mean, that amounts to what, like a series of days of their profits, right? I mean,
I saw one report that said 5 weeks. You know, it could be another report. It was 7 weeks. You know, of profits. So it's ridiculous. And again, it doesn't. This is the bank's money. It's not the money of the individuals involved. If this was a normal drug case, they would have gone into every executive's. You know, any executive who had been involved in this activity, they would have gone to his house, his car, his bank account, and they would have started nosing around in his relatives' assets as well. And they didn't do any of that here. And here's the other thing that's amazing about it: in a typical drug case, they never tell you when they're finished. You know, they don't announce to you, by the way, we've finished investigating you, we've finished taking your stuff. You can go move to Montana now and not worry about the future. The cloud of suspicion never gets lifted from you. In this case, they went and they held a press conference and they essentially told the entire world that we're just not going to do anything. So that's another way that makes the thing that this is different from a normal drug case.
And we should say, all right, before we get to sort of the broader implications of this, because, you know, this is, rather than maintaining the integrity of our banking system, it's basically saying, you know, here's what the bottom line is, guys. We're going to need a 20% VIG off of whatever your take is, essentially. But before we get that, this is a really harsh element of this, particularly since we're nearing the end of the year, and we know how important bonuses are to these bankers. You quoted from Brewer's announcement in your piece at RollingStone.com about this. I got to read this because it is so it's just
surreal.
It's surreal. As a result of the government's investigation, HSBC has, quote, clawed back deferred compensation bonuses given to some of its most senior U.S. anti-money laundering and compliance officers and agreed to partially defer bonus compensation for most of its senior officials during the five-year period of the deferred prosecution agreement. Give us clarify for us what that means.
So some of the top executives will have to wait to receive some of their bonuses for 5 years. So some people will receive everything on time. Some people will receive most of their bonuses on time, but will have to wait a little while to receive it. But, you know, they couldn't possibly have parsed it more. You know, our punishment is you get everything that you're, you know, all of your ill-gotten gains you get to keep. But you might have to wait a little while in some cases.
This is this is a one sentence statement that has the word some, partially, defer, most.
Right.
I mean, this is just like, this sounds like this three guys who we basically said, you guys are just going to have to wait, but we'll put it in an interest accruing account or something. You know, I'm sure that we've actually invested it in your own drug laundering money operation, so you should do quite well.
Yeah, no, again, if a real prosecutor when they're facing a bank that had already admitted to violating the Trading with the Enemy Act. I mean, again, if you think about what they did to other people, where they're taking them, putting them on planes and C-130s and flying them to Guantanamo Bay in the middle of the night, or Syria or someplace, and, you know, skipping the due process altogether. And then you contrast it with this, where they don't even take the bonuses away. They beg them pretty please to, you know, defer it a little bit in some cases. It's just, one prosecutor put it to me this way: just, these guys have no balls. They're not, a natural prosecutor's instinct is just to be, is to have that thing inside you that's just like, I'm going to get these guys. You know, you just want to get the bad guys and you want to make them hurt. And that's just, that pugnacity is supposed to be part of the profile of this job. And this is exactly what you don't have in this Justice Department. These people are, you know, they're not the Jack McCoy that you see in Law and Order. You know, they just don't want to, they want to work with the people that they're prosecuting. It's just weird more than anything. I don't know.
That's a great point. I know a guy who is a assistant USA, and I got to imagine that because Lanny Brewer, I think, came with Holder from, Covington and some
right.
White Shoe law firm. And so
exactly.
These guys are all sort of used to sort of transactional, and they've all been working on the other side of the coin here, as it were. And I can imagine at one point, I mean, you know, the scare tactics of like, look, this is really difficult. This is about complex financial instruments and this is a very tenuous financial, system. We can't go after them for this stuff that we don't really understand about. But this is just sort of cops and robbers stuff. And I got to imagine this is one of the most demoralizing things for people who are career prosecutors, who are young prosecutors,
right.
who are sitting in the Department of Justice going, what's it going to take? I mean, would they, if these senior executives, killed somebody in their bank, but as long as they were using, like, they used the safe, we can't touch them.
Yeah, no, it's completely demoralizing. That's what you're going to be hearing from people who are real prosecutors. I think I don't think it's a surprise that two of the biggest critics of this deal were Neil Barofsky and Elliot Spitzer, who are exactly those kinds of prosecutors who. The way they look at it, they don't come from those white shoe law firms where the way you approach a problem is to get everybody in a room and work it out so that everybody comes out happy. That's not the way prosecuting works. When you're a prosecutor, you represent the people, and your job is to take the biggest bite out of a criminal you can take. Assuming, of course, that he's guilty and that he's done something terribly wrong, if there are mitigating circumstances, it's his job to take that into consideration as well. But that's not the case here. This is a case where a bank that had plenty of other ways to make money legally, and if you look around the financial landscape, nobody's doing poorly. I mean, among these too big to fail banks, they're all making plenty of money. And what they did is they entered into financial arrangements with mass murderers. And so if you're a prosecutor, you have these guys by the proverbial short and curlies. You should be able to exact the wrath of the people. You know, that should be your job. That should be everything you're thinking about. And these guys think in exactly the opposite direction. That's just not who they are, and that's the problem. It's not like we need a new policy here, we need a new law here. We just need different people doing this job.
You know, one of the things I think that people, when they read this story or they just see the headline, they assume that there is some measure of complication here. Like, you know, it was just sort of like a certain level of incompetence and poor double checking in the bank system, but literally. One of the stories that you talked about in this piece is the way that these guys would show up with the cash that they were laundering.
Right.
Tell us about that, because that this is just, it's amazing.
Yeah, I think it was the Sinaloa drug cartel, the Mexican drug cartel. They were bringing hundreds of thousands of dollars of cash into HSBC branches at a time.
Now, where are these branches? Are these like in small villages in Mexico? Or are they actually like in cities where, you know, this isn't just, you know, a country bumpkin is sitting at the teller. This is not, you know, this is not like some type of regional bank or, you know, the local credit union. There are real sort of, you know, standards and regulations, supposedly, that for an international bank like this.
Yeah, well, I don't know exactly where they did this. I'm assuming that they were in big cities, and you know, like HSBC is an internationally chartered institution, so they definitely have standards. They can't just open a bank in the middle of nowhere and suddenly have a different set of rules that they adhere to in the United States for, you know, bringing in money. They have to adhere to their rules, the same rules all over the world. But these guys apparently were frustrated with the inefficiency with which they were washing their drug money, and so they built special boxes to fit in through HSBC's teller windows so that they would exactly conform to the dimensions of those teller windows, so that they could pack the boxes ahead of time and just walk into the bank and slide them through the windows as efficiently as possible, which tells you a lot of things. I mean, it tells you that they were doing this long enough and planned to keep doing it long enough that they had to come up with a system. And it also tells you that there was so much money involved that a box that was an inch too small on the edges was a serious constraint to them. So I mean, it's just an incredible story, and the notion that this was something that was just overlooked on a line item somewhere, we know that's not true. There are whistleblowers that have come forward that have been written about who have testified that the bank knew about hundreds of alerts and for questionable transactions and was just routinely ignoring them and sending them through anyway. So it's grotesque. This is just grotesque behavior that is being unpunished.
And we should say, I want to also take to reiterate that the chair of the bank did say that they were really, really sorry.
Exactly.
And what does this do? I mean, is there, you know, I've read that supposedly this creates some lack of confidence in the banking system, and I'm skeptical of that simply because it seems to be part and parcel of the banking system, and that there is, you know, the major institutional players are, I get the feeling, are just like, yeah, of course this is part of the business, and it is edifying to know that we have a guy in the Justice Department who is not going to, crack down on it in any type of meaningful way. It may raise the percentage of doing business, slightly, but that would have, we also had to hire more tellers to take all that cash, which is also a cost. I mean, these are all just sort of costs of doing business for them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I think was humorous about the story is that when they were sent the cease and desist letter a couple of years ago, and they were told to hire new personnel to supervise money laundering activities and to keep a closer eye on things, all they did is they took people from their credit card collections departments, you know, the people who call up people who are delinquent in their accounts and say, are you, you know, is so-and-so home and where's that $31 that you owe us? They just took all those people and they turned them into money laundering experts who were assigned to review alerts for possible money laundering activity. Uh, So, I mean, that's the kind of cost of doing business we're talking about. I mean, they didn't.
So they take call centers. They take people from their call centers, and with all due respect to people working at their call centers, but they basically say, now you are officers of the bank who are in charge of making sure you're basically fraud control.
Right. Yeah. You're now going to be in charge of looking at bank accounts and deciding whether or not this is like a Hamas or a an Al Qaeda account. And so that's exactly what they did.
It's so hard to absorb this, and it's also just, you know, it really does lay bare why we got no prosecutions, no genuine investigations of what the banks were doing in terms of the financial crisis, because there's just no accountability for these banks, no matter what they do. It's just stunning to me. And
it sends the message to absolutely everybody that you know, you can do it again. I think that's the number one thing that people got out of this is that no individual consequence for any of the people involved in this incredible activity means that not only can you do it again and not have to worry, but financially it still worked out to be a profitable thing for this bank, because they paid a $2 billion fine for laundering $9 billion, and you know that's only what we know about. There was a similar case involving a British bank called Standard Chartered, for violating sanctions with Iran. They were laundering billions of dollars through that country, and they paid the $347 million fine. So where's the downside? You know, I mean, if you're gonna do this, you're not gonna go to jail. You're not gonna pay a fine, and your company might actually make more money in the end. So that's the message to everybody all across the financial system: is just take as much illegal money as you can, and don't worry about it.
I know you got to go in a bit, but I just want to get your response to another story that is somewhat unrelated, but it's vaguely on your beat. Cerberus,
right,
huge hedge fund owned by a guy, Steve Feinberg, I guess it is. And
right.
Steven
right.
Feinberg. And they turn out to be the owners, of course, through their subsidiary, Freedom Group. The owners, it's not a joke, the Freedom Group of basically have amassed all the major gun makers in this country, including Bushmaster, which was the brand of the automatic, semi-automatic rifle that was used in Newtown, Connecticut, for this horrible massacre there. And apparently on Tuesday, they announced that they were going to sell the Freedom Group. And the story at first came out that they were getting a lot of pressure from their institutional investors. California has its pension account with them. I guess New York has some pensions accounts with them. The California Teachers Pension Fund has $750 million invested with them. And they were all calling, basically saying, we don't want to be associated with this. And so supposedly they're reacting
right.
to this. But then it also turns out that Steven Feinberg.
Feinberg's dad lives in Newtown, right?
Yes, his father lives in Newtown. And apparently the elder Feinberg would not return phone calls, but Bloomberg had quoted him as saying the shooting was devastating, horrendous, truly horrendous. You know, it seems to me that if a hedge fund can make this decision that it's not going to destroy their business, that at the end of the day, this is in do it. I'm convinced that had Steven Feinberg's dad lived in Maryland or something, or lived in Darien, Connecticut, that the chances of them selling this would be even that much lesser. that this is a classic case of these people seeing no cost to society with whatever they do. And it really just comes down to, like, I don't want it to be uncomfortable if I go home for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I completely agree with you about that. It's funny, you know, I when I did a story about private equity firms or and Bain Capital last year, I don't know how many people I talked to who said, yeah, you know, Bain, they suck, but the company you really should be writing about is Cerberus. Like, you think the Bain guys are mean? Like, you know, the Cerberus people are there, even on Wall Street, they're considered, you know, their name is sort of mentioned with and you hear the whinny in the back of the horse in the background, like in Young Frankenstein, you know. It's the Feinberg was actually famous for saying that if anybody in his company allowed himself to be photographed, that they would kill him, and then the jail sentence would be worth it, because they're that determined to stay out of the public eye. So in that sense, this story does make a little bit of sense, because they probably just don't want to be in the news, right, and being associated with this massacre. But you know, these private equity firms, these takeover companies, what they're known for is going into a factory town and basically leveling the entire play, you know, the entire landscape. And not having any concern about it because they don't live there. That's always been the criticism of this kind of company, is that they do not act like owners of companies. They act like people who are there to extract value out of an asset. And so not caring is a big part of what they do. It's a big part of their ability to function as deal makers. And so it's just not believable that they would do something out of, you know, social concern. It's totally believable that Steven Feinberg would not want to go home for the holidays and have to hear from a bunch of neighbors about what a jerk he is. That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, it's just sickening. But I mean, it's just sickening. And it's a classic case too. I mean, like you say, these guys function like slumlords who buy up, you know, these buildings, rent them out, don't provide any, you know, service for these buildings, let them just fall apart, keep renting them, you know, to more and more desperate people, and then just, you know, walk away, have the building condemned or something like that, and get a tax write-off. That's more or less what they do with these companies. So the idea that he cares about what's going on in any community. Obviously, you don't own all the gun shops in the country if you care about shootings, until that day where it's like, this is going to make that one day a year I go back to visit my dad really uncomfortable. Sell it.
Right, right. Yeah, no, your entire financial model is based on your not caring. I mean, that's just, you know, their allegiance is entirely, you know, not to the public. It's to the people who invest in the takeovers of these companies, and in, you know, in the ownership of these gun shops, and they have to be absolutely ruthless about everything in order to satisfy their investors and their partners, the idea that they would suddenly grow a conscience and be queasy about gun deaths is a little ridiculous. It just doesn't make any sense. Like, you know, were they worried about the other 15,000 gun deaths in the United States last year? I don't think so.
No,
so,
no, I mean, I don't think so. All right. Well, Matt Taibbi, always a pleasure to talk to you. Have a great new year and holiday, and talk to you again in 2013.
Absolutely. Have a good holiday, Sam. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, folks. We are going to head into the better half of the program. Yes. Yes, it's even better. Number 646-257-3920. A little bit of just house cleaning. Tomorrow on the program, we will have a new show for you. Krista Freeland will be here to talk to us about her latest book. And it's a pre-record, but none of you have heard it before. and just caught up with her last week. On Friday, we will have our last live show of 2012. Joining me will be Cliff Schechter and, I believe, the final showdown between, well, not, I mean, I don't know why I say I believe. I mean, I believe they're both going to show up. Isabel Gillies and Matthew Film Guy will be brought on simultaneously, assuming I can figure out the technology. And I know this is because what happens is like matter, antimatter. Something horrible could go awry. But assuming something horrible does not go awry, they will be here to tell me which is the one film I must see before the clock strikes 12 on December 31st, 2012. And presumably you too, but really me.
Sadly, this occurrence of these two coming on at the same time to give you the movie you must see might come a bit too late if the world actually ends on Friday.
Ew. Is it supposed to, do we know what time it's supposed to end on Friday?
I always just assume midnight.
Midnight.
Like December 21st midnight.
Oh.
Like the world's supposed to end at December 21st, according to the Mayan calendar.
Well, but we may not, that would mean we wouldn't even have a show.
That's what I'm saying.
Am I on now?
Yeah.
Am I on? I would say on the non-world-ending beat that whatever this movie is, I would watch it quickly before Sam comes back and gives you the ending.
Oh, all right. Well, there you go. Michael making a joke about the fact that I gave away the ending for Skyfall.
Twice.
Maybe I'll do it. Maybe I will. Maybe you'll have to cut it out again. What do you think about that? All right, folks, the number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. Coming up in the better half of the program, more on the deal and the really unfortunate for the White House, fortunate for the rest of us, difficult time the White House has had in the past 24 hours as they rolled out their deal universally panned by almost every quarter of the, not just the left, not just the professional left, but the professional center left, even. And that, even the Beltway left, supposed left pundits came out and said, what the F with this deal from President Obama? What a joke. And again, you know, we had a big, one of the things that we're going to do for our best of shows next week is we're going to combine some of our phone calls that we get, some of the libertarian calls, some of the non-libertarian calls. Yesterday, we had a couple of very interesting phone calls in the better half of the program. And, you know, the issue isn't, for me, whether President Obama is a good guy or a bad guy or whether he's a weak negotiator or a good negotiator. I mean, at the very least, that issue is quite settled at this point. The question is, where do we get most of our leverage? And it comes from our House and Senate members. So make sure that either you click through on that Credo action link that we've provided. I think they've assembled with a bunch of other groups to give you numbers to call your congresspeople and your Senate. Again, I remind you, if your congressperson and your senators are Democrats, you call them and you tell them no cuts to Social Security. I know the CPI is a cut to Social Security. You don't need to tell them anything more than that. They'll mark it down their little books. And if you're calling a Republican, if your members are Republican, you could do something that will have equal amount of value. And that is, if you vote for any tax increase, I don't care on who it is, on any Americans, including that CPI, which I also know is a tax on middle-class people, you are a freedom hater. You are a liberty destroyer. You're going to let them take away our guns, and you're going to – you got to sound crazy because you got to you want them to believe that you're a Republican. You tell them you're going to take away our freedom, and we're going to remember this. Tea Party forever. And then you yell something like either you yell Tea Party forever just freedom or Wolverines as you hang up the phone. And
allude to having a don't tread on me flag, too.
That's right. Anything you can drop in there will be
effective. Taxes originated in Islam. Start, just throw everything.
There you go. Yeah, you got to throw the full book at him, the full Monty. All right, we're going to take a break when we come back. Well, I got also this story about those yacht owners going galt.
That is a great story.
Out in California. And the one of the libertarian, what are the libertarian-leaning so-called intellectual pillars of the right, one of the sensible conservatives, has a very interesting plan to prevent mass shootings. It involves bum-rushing the shooter. We'll get to that in the better half of the program.
We also have that wonderful pastor guy.
Oh, yes. We're going to hear from what Jesus is going to tell us caused the this horrible tragedy in Connecticut. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this.